That's literally all Bitcoin is. There's no money in there. There's no energy in there. There's no things in there. There's no enforcement of like what you'll get for your Bitcoin. Like there's no concept of price in Bitcoin. There's not even any trading in Bitcoin. There's no, like when people say a transaction, like there's no tit for tat behavior that happens in Bitcoin.
You're listening to the Wake Up Podcast with Alex Fetsky. The place where the most dynamic thinkers and practitioners in the world drop truth bombs and contrarian viewpoints to help you become the best version of yourself. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. John Cavallo joins me for part two of our mini-series. And in this episode, we discuss Bitcoin as a game. John famously hates metaphors, and he looks at Bitcoin not as money, not as energy, not as a battery, but as specifically game. We also get into religion and evolution, this idea of consuming reality, awareness, and consciousness. And we dig into the company that he's founded and all of the things that he's working on there, new primitives for the web of trust, building an entirely new set of protocols for the web. You can follow John's work at Bitcoin Aerolog and Synonym _2. Remember to subscribe to the show, rate us, send us a boost, and enjoy this episode. Okay, man. I wanna move over to a topic which, when we kind of first met, we discussed, which is this idea of Bitcoin is a game. And I like that framing, and I've actually used that framing in specific discussions that I've had with people. And can you maybe give an overview, and then we can start digging into different elements and what it means.
This is actually, some of the Good Morning tweets are about this as well. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that, like, if you need a definition for Bitcoin that is like honest and, in my opinion, irrefutable and isn't filled with bullshit, it's not that Bitcoin is money, because like money is a whole bullshit loaded topic in the first place. It's that Bitcoin is a game, and basically Bitcoin is the most abstracted networked game, you know, maximum participant kind of game that we've been able to design so far. And the reason why you can define it this way, instead of say this is a philosophy or a theory about Bitcoin, is that literally what Bitcoin does is it has accounts, basically players, and it has scores, you know, these UTXOs with an amount of numbers in them. And that's all they are, is they're just numbers. Like, that's literally all Bitcoin is. There's no money in there. There's no energy in there. There's no things in there. There's no enforcement of like what you'll get for your Bitcoin. Like, there's no concept of price in Bitcoin. There's not even any trading in Bitcoin. There's no, like when people say a transaction, like there's no tit for tat behavior that happens in Bitcoin. There's, I submit an update to the database for like what the new score should be, and I can prove that I have the rights to change the score, and then miners add it and they update the ledger, and that's it. And so you have this kind of enforceable game where the rules you always can rely on, and that the only way to change the scores of the game is basically either to administer the game as a miner, enforce the rules, basically participate, and at least partially and help enforce the rules, or to convince somebody else to give you some of their score. And that's it. And so if you think about this abstraction, you think, okay, what situation are we talking about here where we have, you know, a bunch of accounts that could be just every single person on Earth, for example, and every single person on Earth now has a score. It's like, there's a lot of ways you could look at this. You could say it's like a social credit system of a sort. It's just highly, highly abstracted. There's no attachment to like whether you're a good person or whether you, you know, have a lot of followers or whether you are successful in business, although that one is there a little bit, because you're more likely to be able to use resources to convince somebody else to give you more score, mm-hmm. right? And so using Bitcoin as money makes a lot of sense, because this is a very practical way to get people to let you increase your score. You say, if you give me the, if you give me something, I will increase your score, right? And so what is the object of the game? I think the object of the game is competition. Basically, the idea is that, and this is why we need as many people as possible using Bitcoin. And this is why shitcoins are, you know, a blight on humanity, because what they do is they create all these sub games. And you notice this, and this kind of extends my definition here, where what happens in shitcoins is they become even more strictly games. They care they so what? Little. They become strictly? Even more strictly a game, because it's all Ponzi schemes, right? And this is like the most raw form of game. It's basically rolling a dice, saying we're just going to, on some level, no matter how abstract, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. There's going to be people who leave this game with more value and people who exit with less value, and we'll let them decide how to sort each other out. And so at the end, there will be sorting. There will be people who lose and then, and thus are more likely to, less likely to reproduce, more likely to die, you know, et cetera. Like in a very abstract way, what this is the game of evolution. And so we're basically saying we're using this as a substrate for expressing digitally this evolutionary competition, this culture competition. It's like the ability to gain resources, competition, all of these things. And if we all converge on one game, if we all play the Bitcoin game, it becomes the fairest and the most comprehensive game. And so
why?
This is why we...
Why is the fairest and most comprehensive?
Because if you have, the more people you have in it, the more you have playing by the same rules, and the rules are all enforced. And so thus we're all playing the same game. And if you have people playing other games, like playing the Ethereum game, that means we won't get to get their data in our game until they leave that game and come to our game. And so while you could consider them to be sub games or splinter games, they're not part of our game. And thus they create like these fractals that are separate. And so since they're not contained within Bitcoin, we can't actually measure them within the entire scope of reality. And so
and that's bad,
scaling
because
reasons are we can't anyway. Well, it's bad because if we truly wanted to know, you know, what the most valuable thing you could do is, we would need everybody, you know, in that system. Mm-hmm. And so if you have separate systems, then you don't get a full data set. Think of it, here's another way you could think of it. Like nodes have to exist somewhere geographically, right? Like they have to be in the real world on Earth. I guess they don't have to be on Earth, but you get the idea. They have to be somewhere placed, you know, within a three-dimensional, you know, grid of reality, and they exist, you know, positionally. And so what you get is when somebody moves Bitcoin, it actually literally transfers value. It takes a signal from reality, say in like Nigeria, somebody has a Bitcoin node and they earn some money and they buy some Bitcoin. And that it takes that and it uses it as like a signal, a sensor of reality, and it maps it digitally into the ledger. Mm-hmm. Now this person, there's a change. Now this node, this person has Bitcoin and didn't have it before or has more. And then if that person sends Bitcoin to someone in China, then now you see a transfer of value. And these are all things that are happening in reality. So it's like nodes act as sensors for what's happening in the physical world. And this gets translated into scores in the digital realm. And, you know, if you have everybody using the same global system, you would have a complete system, right?
So it's like the map represents a territory. Like, so the map represents a territory more accurately when everyone's using the same sort of map, right?
Right. You can't map the territory if there's a black spot on it, if it's blacked out. If you know what I mean? If you don't have any Bitcoin nodes there, you're not getting any data from there. Now, whether that, you know, you certainly could argue that maybe it's better to have separate games and separate systems, and maybe they have to graduate to the system, and like, because you can't have all the data all the time, all the things, it'll melt your face off. Like you can't, you know, you just can't have everything all the time. So there's always going to be some physical limit. Like for example, if I say we get the whole Earth using it, now we want the whole, you know, we discover another civilization, we want them using it too. Like why not, right? It's all of reality that we want in this game. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But the idea is just basically Bitcoin is an abstraction, and it's like the most abstracted value tracking system that we've ever devised. Because it's enforceable, and there is no like money quality to it. There's no, it's not a bank, it's not currency, it's just numbers attached to an account number, and that's it. That's like all it is. Anything else we say that it is, we project definition onto it. If we use Bitcoin as money, it doesn't mean that Bitcoin is money. Like money is how you use something. Bananas can be money, you know, teacups can be money. It's just how you use them. If you use them to represent abstraction. And so depends on how you want to define money, if whether Bitcoin is money, but it certainly is used as money. And I just like the idea of looking at it this way.
So, okay. Semantics in some sense. How do you define money then? Just out of curiosity.
I try to avoid topics like this, honestly. It's like, tell me, let's talk about politics. That's what I hear when you say, let's talk about money. It's like a whole bunch of bullshit. Like people want to talk about, you know, Mises and Rothbard, and they want to talk about all these things. And I'm just like, I don't give a fuck about any of that. All I know is that I have this way of storing value, and literally a value, a number. And mm-hmm. people currently will give me, you know, stuff for it. They'll give me buying mm-hmm. power for it. And I can't necessarily go to the store across the street and buy something with it. But I know that if I store value in there, that over the long term, that that is a reliable way to store value. And that, to me, is good enough. I don't need whatever you want to call money. But I also know that if I hold dollar bills, that those are money. And those have their own qualities to them and their own trade-offs to them as well. So it's like, who gives a shit what money is? Like, I don't care. Why do I have to, like, oh, first something is a store of value, and then it is a medium of exchange, and then it is a currency. It's like, there's no formula to whether something is useful. Mm-hmm. It's either useful or it's not. And Bitcoin is not useful in all the same exact ways that a credit card is. You know, a credit card is not useful in all the same ways that a dollar bill is. Like, what the fuck is money if all these things are money? If I can define everything as money, bananas are money, then it's a useless concept.
Okay. The defining everything as money is a, you know, is a cop out, because at some stage everything has performed as money. But to how do I phrase this? It's kind of like the way you described the game and what human beings do, because we're all playing a game of life in some sense, and we're all trying to, you know, have some sort of score in our own lives, in whatever we find meaningful, whether that's, you know, reputational or resource wise or whatever, right? You know, Bitcoin, I guess, allows us to measure that more. But isn't a good definition of money, you know, some sort of, I'm not talking about money the object, because I guess you could, you know, money the object can change, and it has. It's changed from fucking salt to bananas to whatever, right? There's
no object that is money. That's the thing.
Yeah, like, well, that's exactly.
Money is how you use an object.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So money in a metaphysical sense, you know, couldn't we at least agree that money is kind of like this magical ledger in the sky, that's what money is. Money is a scorecard. Money is a game. Or, sorry, money is the scorecard, and the game is probably existence. And Bitcoin is the thing that best able to use that, or has the attributes that could help us play the game and measure the score most accurately.
Well, so one thing I should have mentioned in describing the game idea is, a big reason why the game is interesting is that it's a fixed total quantity of score. Mm-hmm. 21 million Bitcoin, or 2.1 quadrillion Satoshis, however mm-hmm. you want to look at it. Because it's fixed, it means that the only way you can get it is from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You can't print it. You can't inflate it. You can't basically change the rules of the game indirectly. You can't steal resources from other users. You know, you have to convince them somehow, or you mm-hmm. have to like beat them over the head and take it from them. Like mm-hmm. you have to actually do something in reality to get Bitcoin. You can't just like print it. And so that makes the game much more interesting and much more useful. And I think that calling it money does it a disservice, because money traditionally just is what people use as an abstraction for value. Now, money so far, like, it could be shells, and people find more shells and they use those shells, and that's not necessarily bad. And you could even argue that there's benefits to inflation for certain, you know, designs. And so what is money? What is the best money? It doesn't matter. Like, money is going to be the most popular small thing. And that most popular small thing that we accepted as, you know, a substitute for barter. And that's what money was invented to do, is a convenience technology to prevent the inconvenience of barter, where I had two bananas and you had a goat, and I didn't want a whole goat, and you didn't, and two bananas is not enough, but you wanted bananas from me, and we had to find some way of breaking the goat into pieces and giving me partial value, you know, like,
yeah. But barter is kind of like the really, you know, the hard way of keeping score of the game, right? Because it's, as you said, it's kind of like we're all playing with fucked up units.
Everything is barter. It's just, money is just the most popular item, so it has the most predictable price. And so, like, if everybody only ate snails,
that's the object of money, though.
And snails required some effort to collect, but they were everywhere, and everybody ate them every day. Like, we would use them as money. We would just say, okay, well, I'll give you 10 snails, and say snails never died. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
This gets into, like, quality. This is why people try to define qualities of money. It's like, if it's portable, if it is, you know, available, it's like all these different qualities that be durable. Like, yeah, bananas are horrible money. They only last a week. Like, it's not very good money, but it can certainly be used as a substitute for value if you don't need bananas and you know somebody else that does. You know?
Totally. I think the confusion for me always lies in the fact that trying to express money as an object or a good is where you end up getting stuck, because then you have to find an object of good. I've always, maybe not always, but at least where my understanding has come to is, basically, tomato, tomato, with your representational description of this game that humans play, and why Bitcoin is such a useful, I guess, technology for playing the game of existence. Because for me, money's metaphysical. The currency that we use to represent money is the object that changes all the time, and that can be bananas or snails or dollar bills or Bitcoin or whatever. But for me, I've always kind of thought of money effectively as a metaphysical abstraction, in much the same way as a game is. That's why I said it's kind of semantics at this point, because it is the same definition as you've given to Bitcoin in many ways.
You can't talk metaphysical without agreeing on definitions. You know, you need semantics, because if something means everything, it becomes a useless term. And so you have to kind of agree on definitions of things to be able to talk about something that is abstract. Like, you just have to, or you're just going to be bullshitting back and forth to each other. I don't know. Like I said in the beginning, it's not important to me whether Bitcoin is money. It's just important that it does what I need it to do. And if we start making rules for it about that it is money, or that it's the best money, then we start having to define money. We start having to say what is and is not money. And then people will say, okay, but Bitcoin doesn't do this one thing that money does, so it's not money. And you're just going to get into these, like, stupid arguments with people about bullshit. And the truth is, Bitcoin does not do everything. It fails at certain things. It does not scale. We haven't figured out how to actually get everybody in here. It's going to be really expensive.
That's fine. And all money fails.
It's not evenly distributed. Like, there's all kinds of problems. But it's still the best, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to the game concept, I wanted to get into talking about, earlier I mentioned a couple times, like, competition. And I think that that's another reason why it's important to think of it as a game, is because I see, like, this is much more metaphysical, but I see the human race as like having this dichotomy of cooperation and competition. And basically, if you can trust people, you can find people that you trust and trust you back, you can cooperate, or you can not trust people and you can compete. And I think that this is like an evolutionary process that we've developed for remaining adaptable as a social creature. And so we are social creatures. We need other humans because we can't reproduce without them and we will die. And so you always need at least one other human to trust you and cooperate with you. Because even if like we had like raped women, they would just kill your baby if they didn't want you. You know what I mean? Like you need cooperation. Like you need society, you need social, you know, behavior. And so we have to cooperate, but we also have to compete at the same time because resources are limited as a general concept. And so since resources are limited, we have to, and the future is uncertain and the environment is always changing, we have to be as hardy and adaptable as possible. And so we need competition. And so Bitcoin is a great way to abstract this competition, to basically say, okay, if you do a good job for a lot of people and you do good work and you become valuable to society, you should be able to accumulate a higher score, right? You'll have more resources that you don't need to use actively every day. You have, you know, excess resources that you can save and thus have a higher score. And if that score dictates or somewhat reflects or even wholly reflects your value to society, then, in other words, the game is as fair as possible and excludes as many people as possible. You get both the representation of cooperation and competition. Mm-hmm. And so your bloodline might last longer because you have resources that you can pass to the next generation. You know, you have more, because you're more intelligent or more effective, you have more resources that you can deploy for the sake of humanity or your bloodline. Like, this is what riches are supposed to be, right? It's supposed to be that if you are actually a better human, that you are trusted with more of the resources and thus able to be a leader and last longer as a bloodline and have more children, etc.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You said riches. So, I mean, see, everything you're describing now, like the outcome of the game is, I guess, to me, the definition of why the fuck we even have money. This is like money's the fucking score, right? Like, I mean, it's
I don't think it's why it was invented, but it certainly makes sense in the context of the game.
Yeah.
You know, if we were to digitize evolution, I think you'd have to start with something like Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
If not Bitcoin itself.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I still sit in the camp that, I mean, at the end of the day, these are all like metaphors of trying to grapple with understanding what Bitcoin is, because human beings, you know, I think we understand best through narrative and metaphor. That's, we have always been like that, and I think we'll always be like that. When you look at a chair, you don't see a chair, you see a sitting thing, right? So I guess, first of all, do you agree with that as a statement?
I don't know. I would just revert to where I started, which is like, I can't think of a better definition of Bitcoin. And so you say, like, what is Bitcoin at its core? It is accounts, it is scores, and it is a system for transferring scores. Mm-hmm. And that's like, that is definitional. Like, there's no abstraction there. There's no lies there. There's no added context. And there's no context in the protocol. So what better definition could you make for it? If you start calling it money, then you have to meet everybody's definition of money. But if you call it a game, then people know that a game has players and scores.
Okay, so that's fair. So your argument then is that a definition, a straight definition is better than abstracted metaphor for helping people understand what Bitcoin is.
I don't know if it's better. I mean, it's better for
you.
It's easier for me to understand. Okay. And it's certainly one that if I explain it this way, people can't refute it very easily.
Mm-hmm.
If you start explaining it as money to people, well, gold bugs will argue with you. Bankers will argue with you. Normies will argue with you. Like it's riddled with problems, you know, to call it money. It's not like any money anybody else ever saw, but everybody has played a game. Everybody has lost a game. Everybody has gotten a score and raised their score. I guess maybe the hardest concept of calling this a game is that the only way to get points is from somebody, from another player. That's
Well, I think there's that. Distinct. I think maybe the other challenge is also people's. I mean, when I think of a game, I think, well, why should I fucking play your game? I'll play my game. And you know, why can't I start my own game? You know, maybe we end up in Eric Voorhees territory, which is what? Why well, should
that's
I?
That's exactly what they do. They say,
well, correct. Yeah.
They see that the game started without them, mm-hmm. and they say, well, that's no fair. I don't want to play a game that started without me. It's like walking in on a game of Monopoly, and now everybody and somebody owns Boardwalk, and somebody owns you know half the board, and you're like, now you're going to start playing. That sucks, right? and even if you could buy in at fair value, it still sucks. And because you see other people started without you and they were able to accumulate resources before you. So you go and you invent Ethereum and you go and invent Solana. And then you say, okay, well, how do I get, now my game, nobody wants to play my game. It's worthless. And how do I get people to play my game? Well, you make narratives. You say, well, my game is better than Monopoly. My name, if you play my game, you not only can you play Monopoly, but you can play Ponzi's and you can play all kinds of bullshit.
Yeah. So basically the complexity, trying to define, trying to define Bitcoin, whether as a game or as money, comes with its own challenges. When you're trying to define it as money, then you're going to have refutations from gold bugs and bankers and this and that about what the fuck money is. But then when you define it as a game, you're going to then have to refute every other monkey that wants to create their own game, and the dimension of the argument kind of changes, right?
Maybe, but in the end, we're going to be left with monkeys creating games and people not believing in Bitcoin. And, you know, like, I don't know that anything would be different if we started with this definition. We'll never know. You only get to see one reality. I just know that, like, from my years of thinking about Bitcoin, when I came to this kind of realization and definition, and it feels a lot better than talking about money to me.
I fucking love it. I think it's a really great thing. At least the what feels good for me though is that I view existence as a game and I view money as the scorecard. So it dovetails very nicely in this. But that's my personal definition of what money is.
That's partly why I like it. I've always been very, very influenced by evolution as a role within reality and within humanity. And you know, like, a lot of this theory comes from, like, when I was really young, I read a book called The Red Queen by Matt Ridley, and he's this guy who's like, he's progressed to being into like memetics and other things like this. He's kind of like a bullshitter a little bit at this point, but back then it was a pretty novel concept to me, and the book is basically about like how like everything in life and all life is about sex, and it's not like a pornography or fetishism or anything like this. It's just about how like everything is affected by reproduction, and life is like all about sex. Like everything we do is to like try to somehow make sure that we have sex, reproduce, and have, you know,
a lineage,
and exist and continue to exist. Yeah.
There's another book of a similar vein. So this guy called Robert Ardrey, who wrote The Territorial Imperative, and he makes the claim that it actually goes beyond sex and that it's territory, that the whole game of existence is about territory, and that sex is a means to establish more territory. So they're interlinked, but it's very, I feel like you would enjoy this.
That into resources. And you could just say more resources. Yeah.
It's of a similar vein. I think you'd enjoy it. It was written in the 60s. It's kind of like old school anthropology, which was like, you know, brutal. None of this fucking new age Yuval Harari fucking, you know, crap that is like mainstream. It was a really good, I read it like 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, and I found it. He's got African Genesis and The Territorial Imperative, and I can't remember what the third book was, but this is a very compelling case about kind of territory being particularly human beings, but all social creatures, North Stars, that is the thing that we're all playing for.
Yeah, I guess it would just depend on how abstract you would define territory, because I could accept that as long as it equated to just more resources. Because now in a technological age, I don't necessarily need to own a whole city block
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And
this,
well,
could,
I guess,
be because of other territory. In other words, this could be because of the territory of the country has been established, and I'm part of that country.
Mm-hmm.
So it and that could still be down to territory.
Yeah.
In the end, you have to exist somewhere, and mm-hmm. you have to exist in a place where you're not going to be killed by the elements or by other people. And so you have to establish some sort of society, and that requires territory, etc.
Yeah. Is there any? So I just want to finish off this this game piece with just one question, and then I want to move into kind of like Web of Trust, and then what you're doing with Synonym. So, is there any other metaphors in and around Bitcoin that you think are useful, or that you found useful when you're trying to? Okay,
I hate metaphors. That's why.
Is it a battery or not?
That's why I called it a definition. That's what, yeah. You know, from the very start, I said this is a definition because I fucking hate metaphors. Yeah. So no,
John,
Bitcoin is not right. Love. Bitcoin is not a mushroom. Bitcoin is not energy. Bitcoin is a game.
Is it a battery? Is it a battery?
No, it is not a battery. No. I can't take anybody seriously when they speak this way. It's just like, I just feel like this is fucking bullshit. I can't do it.
All right. So John's allergic to metaphors.
Yeah.
All right.
Prepare for me to rip into you if you ever throw metaphors in front of me. Like, I can't like, and people say that I'm being too semantic about things, but it's like metaphor is just like spit in the face of like all definition. It's just, I hate it. Yeah.
Are you actually, on that note, do you consider yourself religious, non-religious, Christian, non-Christian, etc.? Like, where do you sit on that spectrum?
I have a theory.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's hear it.
So basically, I think that this, as far as like all the definitions I've ever heard of heaven and hell, this is it. Like, we're living it right now. I believe that the miracle is getting to be alive. And basically getting to witness and manipulate reality. And so we were the molecules so lucky as to be able to actually consume reality and be, mm-hmm. be able to affect it and change it and experience it. And then all the other molecules are just floating around, unaware. And that's the miracle. That's, where all this idea about religion comes from, in my opinion, and doing the right thing and morals, et cetera. It's just all this way of trying to understand this miracle that we've been given to be alive. And I feel that heaven, that this is heaven. Like, when you think of all the definitions of heaven that people have, where it's like, you get 72 virgins, or you see your dead grandmother, or you get reunited with your favorite cat, or whatever, you get to eat what you want every day, you get to get all the answers to life, whatever you think it is. These are all carnal desires. These are all human desires. These are all things you want in this life.
Mm-hmm,
that's why you hope to get them in heaven. And so, to me, heaven is understanding that this is heaven. In other words, knowing that you are in heaven right now, and you have the opportunity right now to make your reality anything you want. You just have to take it. You have to do it. You have to figure out how to make it happen for you. You have to figure out how to have the experience you can while you have time. And hell is not knowing that this is heaven. Hell is thinking that this is something else. Hell is other people feeling like this is hell and not knowing this is heaven and treating you like it's not heaven. Like, hell is pain, is suffering, it's all here. Like, becoming addicted, becoming depressed, like, that's hell. Like, what worse life could you live but one of depression or illness? Or, like, we don't need other hells, You have consequences here for your actions, and the actions of others affect you. You can create hell for yourself and for others. And this is what heaven and hell are to me. It's like how you live your life. Maybe it's this dichotomy of, cooperation and competition, exploiters and producers. Like, there's always this heaven and hell. There's this yin and yang. And so there's always this duality that everybody's trying to bring up. And I think it's just our own ways of trying to understand life. It's nothing to do with how we got here or why we're here or all these things. It's just not really, it's just being thrown into heaven and being like, what the fuck is going on? And that's it. Like, and so as far as whether I'm religious, I say I, in this definition I just gave you, or this theory I just gave you, I believe that it all just ends and disappears when we die. I hope that I'm wrong. I hope there is a God or something that happens after I die, because I don't ever want to die. Like, I want to do this forever. And so I know that that's extremely unlikely, to the point where nobody has ever done that before. But it's what I want, and I would do it if I had the opportunity. And because that's what I believe. I believe that this is heaven, and I would like to stay here as long as possible.
Mm-hmm. You said one word, unaware. So would you kind of say that the gift of the molecule that we've emerged from is the gift of like consciousness in some sense? It's like
self-awareness. Yeah.
Yeah. Self-awareness. Okay, yeah.
I don't know if there's a difference, but, mm-hmm. you know, I just think of it as there are degrees of it as well. Like, you can manipulate reality. You can be aware of reality, but like, an ant is alive and it has a very limited awareness. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, this is where the heaven idea falls apart. I don't know. But, you know, I'm not a philosopher. This is just my way, my mental model, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to have a mental model and make a mental model where everything fits, and try. And if something doesn't fit a mental model, you need to figure out what you've got wrong. And so, like an ant or a fish, like, they have limited nervous systems, they have limited awareness, they're still contributing to life and contributing to our lives even. But, you know, a rock, on the other hand, has no ability to manipulate reality and consume reality. It just sits, right?
There's a book by Robert Persig called The Metaphysics of, no, it's called Leela, and it kind of explores the metaphysics of quality. I think that's a worthwhile read. He kind of talks about, like, it's an inquiry into morals, but of the different substrates of existence. So you've got kind of like matter, which is dumb and non-existent. You have kind of like biological, social, and then I guess calls it intellectual, but it's kind of like consciousness as being kind of like the highest, or complex consciousness or self-awareness, whatever word you want to give it.
Art fits somewhere in there too.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, exactly. And he places art seriously up there. Exactly. That's one of his, he says, you know, art emerged as this kind of qualitative expression of something that is not merely matter related or biology related. It's kind of in the social, intellectual stratum. It's something different, and you know, the more artistic it gets, the more, you know, higher up, I guess, on that structure it gets. It's so to tie it back to the religious question, actually, you know, this piece about consciousness is, would you not agree that, you know, the religious texts and the stories and the narratives are ways of trying to grapple with the heaven and hell we live in, you know, on a daily basis. You know, yes, they've been turned into all sorts of you know, further abstracted narratives of the afterlife, et cetera, et cetera. But in reality, like, they're all stories and narratives about the way or a method of living or contending with reality. Or, I think you use the word consuming reality, that will increase the likelihood of you experiencing heaven and not experiencing hell.
I cannot disagree with anything, but I would maybe explain it a little bit differently. I would say another part of what heaven is probably like this idea of like the Übermensch and like being your best self.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes from the evolution problem. In other words, you know, our brains are designed to make sure that we compete optimally and feel guilty if we do not, to be healthy and feel bad if we are not, and like, we have all these mechanisms in place in our biological system to make us want to be essentially a god, like to be this ultimate version of ourselves, because that is what evolution is trying to achieve. It's trying to iterate on the best humans, and the best human, and it iterates constantly, so it can constantly respond to the environment. And so I think what religions are, and their cultural devices, and just culture in general, is just basically this way of passing on. It's like DNA that you can't touch. It's DNA that's not in your blood. So it's like, as a social creature, as a society, we have all these things that we learn about reality that we can't and haven't figured out how to put in DNA. And so you can't be born with them. And so we train each other, we teach each other these things, and we keep passing them on. And religion is just a structure, like a framework, cultural device. It's like saying, here's a whole set of culture, a whole set of ideas, whole set of learnings that you, if you apply them and pass them on, we have found that this keeps our societies alive and more healthy and more optimal. And so this system, we feel, is the best system for producing supermen, you know? And so please follow the system, and then teach your children, if they don't follow the system, that you will beat them or scold them or not give them rewards, whatever your method, but this is very important. And that's what religion is. It's like, it's just a way to have a mechanism of training humans that there are important things to learn, and that morals will guide your ability to survive. And that if you betray morals, that you are basically, you know, exploiting, you're taking a cost for your own and at the cost of the human race, potentially. And so these are gambles when you exploit and you disobey a moral. There's a risk there. And this is why they say you will go to hell, is because you're creating hell for others when you exploit them. And so thus you are more likely to end up in hell yourself, because they're probably going to want to take you with them. These kinds of things. So I think religion is a template or a framework of cultural devices.
I guess where I was leading with all of this is that I was trying to make a case for the usefulness of metaphors.
So you like the metaphors.
This is a 15-minute trap for John, but because
was I caught? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. look, it's a fascinating set of topics, because I've swung to and from and away and all sorts of shit with respect to religion. I kind of the mental model I use these days. And, you know, people who've heard me on my podcast have heard me say this a couple times. I kind of see, like, you had the original teachings of, say, let's say a figure like Christ or Buddha or whatever, right? And they had, whether through, you know, intuition or, you know, kind of like what you mentioned before, it's like, you know, you're 43, you've learned this gut sort of feeling of being able to sense what is kind of like right or moral or consistent, you know, or, you know, what has integrity versus what doesn't. And, you know, there seems patterns, to be, yeah, patterns. So there are these people that have emerged throughout history multiple times that seem to be masters of pattern recognition, to use that terminology. And they have basically said, look, if you live in this way, this way, this way, this way, you'll, you know, it's the best path to becoming an Übermensch. And then what happens is religions are an interpretation of those original ideas or teachings, and sort of religions are kind of second layer. They're kind of a set of rules that, you know, someone who's either first, second, third hand heard that set of ideas, they kind of turn it into an interpretation of, and there can be multiple interpretations. And then you have the institutionalization of religion, and that's kind of like the church, which is kind of an ossification of the interpretation of the original idea. And it's kind of like the third layer where we kind of get into trouble, because when you're so far from the original idea, you don't actually know why the idea was good in the first place. And you kind of,
well, the problem with culture is that we didn't always have the technology we have today. And, you know, and so I think that religion was a good device, because it was a good way to enforce a template of ideas, you know, over hundreds of years without technology. And so religion probably started as folklore, as old wives' tales, you know, and then it evolved into much more you know, elaborate and complicated systems. And now today we are further evolving it. And so people are moving, you know, it seems like people are moving away from religion, but I don't think they're moving away from cultural devices. In other words, memes are a huge topic, a huge, you know, phenomenon on the internet. And even in Bitcoin, you know, people love their memes, you know, number go up, stack sats, like they have all these devices that they teach others as shorthand. Often metaphors and things like this, but I hate those things. In other words, almost every Bitcoin meme sucks, like because they're not complicated, because they aren't a whole framework it isn't an actual religion. It's like little slices of religion. People misuse them, they abuse them, they misunderstand them, but they trust them and they build on them anyway. And so you get something like number go up, and then I get into a podcast or Twitter space with, like, say somebody well known or respected like NVK, and he says to me, the number has to keep going up. Bitcoin, the particular project, has failed if the number doesn't keep going up. And I'm like, where the fuck did you get that idea? Like, why does the number always have to go up? What does that even mean? Like, if the US dollar dies, does Bitcoin die? Because the number doesn't go up anymore. He goes, no, it just has to go up and buy my buying power. Okay, if everybody starts using Bitcoin and now the population starts going down, is the number supposed to keep going up? It's like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, or people who say never sell. Like, it's the only thing you can do with Bitcoin is sell it. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, I just... these memes, these Bitcoin memes, these metaphors, whatever you want to call them, they're just like way too primitive. Like, they're way too oversimplified, and people trust in them way too much. And they're useful for like getting a rough idea, like, you know, walking in the room, but they're not something that you should be like living by or you know, foisting on people and telling them this is gospel. Like, they're really, really immature, or
well, there's shortcuts, right? There's shortcuts to kind of,
they're used by the lazy, unfortunately.
Yeah, correct. But see, this is, I mean, maybe this is something the human race can never really escape, right? Is that, you know, when you find a shorthand way of expressing something, you end up in a situation where the fact that human beings are fucking lazy, or a large component of them are lazy, you end up in a situation where they end up just replacing the shorthand with the detail.
Yeah.
Maybe, replacing the detail with the shorthand.
Certainly, information does not propagate easily, and it does not propagate with integrity very easily. And context does not propagate easily. And so there's a lot of issues. Actually, we can use that as a segue if you want to Web of Trust and what we're doing.
Yes, let's do it. Yes.
So like, in a way, maybe we're trying to solve these kinds of problems a little bit. So this isn't how I usually would start explaining what we're doing, but it's the first thing coming to the mind because of where we came from. During COVID and during the first year of it, you know, like, there was so much what they would say misinformation. But it would, back in the beginning, it actually was like misinformation. There was misinformation from the government. There was misinformation from the internet. And there was everybody saying, well, this guy knows, you know, this guy invented this. This guy invented mRNA. This guy invented the vaccine. The vaccine came from a lab. The vaccine, there's no way it came from a lab. You just had no way to honestly, like, nobody could honestly, like, with a straight face, just say to you, I know the truth about what's going on with COVID. I know where it came from. I know where I know whether the vaccine works or what it does not work. I know the risks of the vaccine. Nobody had a clue. People just aligned with the information that felt like closest to the patterns that they're used to trusting. And that's the best any of us could do. And I got into a lot of arguments with people because I aligned with the side that I thought it was all a big scam and a big sham. And, like, you know, it's just the flu is my take on it. And I had no evidence of this. It certainly could have and probably was a new kind of flu or a worse flu than typical. But to me, I couldn't distinguish it from the flu and the behaviors of the flu. When I was young, I knew people that got the flu and lost their taste and things like that, weird side effects of, you know, getting sick. Like, this is normal to me. Like, I heard of it before since I was young. But we had no way to like track the integrity of the data. We had no way, like you would see a study, and then you'd have to like read the study about the study, and then the most trusted people that like the Lancet or whatever posted wrong studies, and it was like there's no provenance to trust going on in the system. And so one of the things that we're making is both, I think, will help address things like this, and it also helps address problems that were originally being tried to solve for the web back when the concept of Web3 was first invented, before shitcoiners redefined it. Web3 used to mean the semantic web. It was the ability to add context to data, so you could automatically do things and produce, websites and applications that knew what the things and how the things and what type of things. Like it'd be context to things. And Google was kind of like an early kind of example of an attempt to solve semantic problems. In other words, you put in some semantics in the search engine and it gives you back, contextually relevant things. But Google kind of monopolized this. They basically did solve the problem for everybody, and they became the only provider of it. And this put them in a position to like now be, a huge provider of other services, cloud storage, email, calendars, and now they have view into your whole life. And this is bringing all kinds of risks to us. And so what we do at Synonym is we try to take the phenomenon of Bitcoin and how it has decentralized, value and the ability to kind of, in a peer-to-peer way, have a financial system and an economy with the complementary needs that have to be in place to facilitate that economy. In other words, if we believe that hyper-Bitcoinization is inevitable, what does it actually look like? What happened? What does the internet, the economy, society, how does it reform around now that governments can't print money? How does it reform now that Google doesn't control all your datas? And how does it, or big banks don't have your money, big state can't enforce everything on you, through stealing resources? Like what's in its place? And so I spent a long time trying to like model this and figure out what the like basic core set of software, protocol, features, services would actually need to exist if we were in a hyper Bitcoinized society where there were no more big banks, big tech, or big states. And so the kind of missing piece in all of this was, I could figure out, we needed wallet, we needed servers, we need publishing platforms, we need decentralized stuff and ways of hosting your own stuff. And a lot of these things have been thought about before. And there's a whole like subculture or side industry that's been working on this for decades, like BitTorrent and digital identity and all these concepts. But what was missing was this like glue, the semantics to tie it all together. And ultimately what was needed, in my opinion, is like this way to express mutual definitions of things. And so this is why the company is called Synonym. It's like when one thing by another definition is still the same thing. And so we can mutually agree that a banana is also a fruit, or, that's not a perfect synonym, but you understand what I'm trying to say. Like John is also, a Bitcoiner. You have these multiple definitions of things, but it's all the same thing in the end. And so we take the idea of abstracting everything onto a key pair, much the way that Bitcoin does, into an account. And we, instead of having it be on chain, we just say you just generate key pairs at will. And you use these key pairs to represent any endpoint in the network. It can be a file, it can be an identity, it can be an account, it can be a contact, it can be a server, a website, anything. And how do we remap the whole internet using this as a primitive? So we can attach webs of trust to everything and have this mutual subjective way of networking together. And so, for example, you and I could, say, okay, this is how we form data about movies. And you and I could have our own little web of trust where we rate movies. And, we hit, here's the schema for how you, share the title of the movie, the year it was made, your review of it, how many stars, or, how much percentage you liked it, whatever scoring mechanism you want. And so we have like these three dimensions of data where it's basically like the category or type, the range or score, and the access or permission of that data. And so this basically allows you, if you take these kind of three dimensions and apply them to any data, and that data is always represented as a key, we can mutually agree on things about data. And so you can basically deconstruct what would be Google's search algorithm, and we can put it into our own weighting systems, our own schemas, our own ways, perspectives of data. And through using mutual perspectives, we can actually create entire networks, economies, you know, webs of trust. And so what we do with slash tags is we provide all kinds of different ways to take this key as a primitive and use it as all these things in a protocol. And so you can use slash tags as a website account. Slash tags are just key pairs. You can use them as website accounts. You can use them as contacts. And we pair this with a protocol called HyperCore. And HyperCore is a lot like BitTorrent, except the files are based, they're actually append-only logs. And these append-only logs are actually defined as keys in a DHT. And so you can basically find any key in the DHT in a very cool way, we'll just say, to keep it simple. And it'll route you eventually to a file, to an append-only log that's represented by that key. And within that log, I can keep private data, I can keep public data, I can route you to other logs of other types of data. And it's basically a way of like having this kind of distributed and decentralized sort of cloud and hosting that can be done by anyone and everyone, or only people that care. So think of like how, like when you download a movie from BitTorrent, like you'll get it from like 30 people at once, right? You could have websites hosted this way. You could have your social media as a feed this way. And so basically what we'll end up doing is we're going to release a wallet that supports this along with Bitcoin and Lightning. And it'll support this ability to have these website accounts and these contacts all represented as slash tags keys. We will partner with several like well-known websites where they'll support the ability to create accounts this way. The websites will also have keys so they can prove that they're at the right website. And we're basically going to totally abstract the web away from DNS and domain names and into keys on a DHT. And so you abstract everything away from the centralized and censorable naming systems, and you move them to an open system. And so all the data, you can choose to host it yourself, or you can choose for somebody else to host it for you, but it will have the integrity of your key, because you can't write to your log without key access. And so you have to have been predefined as a key that's allowed to write to the log. And so you can see the integrity of when data is added, who it's added by, and that mm-hmm. that you're getting the right feed from people. And so my Twitter feed or my D Twitter feed would be something I create, and then I share copies of it with D Twitter so they can host it for me and serve it to millions of people. And anytime somebody wants to check whether it was really me that made that data, they'd be able to verify that by downloading that HyperCore and verifying for themselves.
What's their incentive model in that sense to do that for you? Like, are you paying them to serve it or host it?
Yeah, the same incentive. Well, the incentive models can be the same, except now you have maybe more options. In other words, because we're making this all tightly integrated with Bitcoin and the Bitcoin user experience, we're always going to be including ways to monetize everything that you're doing. And so if you want to, say, publish a Twitter feed, you could require that somebody pay to be able to download updates to that feed. Mm-hmm. It would be inherent in the way the protocol works. If you want somebody else to host your Twitter feed, you could pay them to host it for you. And you could have this be on a granular level. Like, you could pay them, stream the data. You could pay them every day or every week or every month. So subscription concepts and allowance concepts. And then if you stopped behaving or they stopped behaving, you just stop paying or stop serving. But anybody can do this, because the idea here is everything is interoperable and everything is provable, because everything is based on keys.
You mentioned DHT. What's that stand for again?
Distributed hash table. It's like the way that BitTorrent works. Like when you use a magnet link, and you go and find a file, like basically what you're doing is you're going to this DHT system. You're saying, find this item for me. And it asks like the closest peers and they tell you the next closest place to look. And this all happens very quickly, like in, you know, a few hundred milliseconds. And it's all of a sudden now you're at the right file. And then now you get the information. A magnet link will, you know, include other information like more peers that have the file and things like this. But generally the DHT and HyperCore is just, it uses like this bit tracing system for eventually you find the key you're looking for and thus the file represented by that key. And so when you look for John, and John will be a key, and then you'll ask the network and the network will just drill down until it finds the HyperCore or the log that is mine. And that is represented by that key. When you read that file, you will copy it and you will know that it's mine. And any public data in it will tell you what you're looking for. Like, for example, maybe in my public profile or this public file, it'll say how you can reach my Lightning node so you can pay me and get an invoice from me, or how you can reach my website, or how you, or which other core is my Twitter feed so you can follow me like directly without using Twitter. Things like this.
Is this because, or is this dependent upon the schema of the data being more structured than it currently is, for example? So you were mentioning those categories of those dimensions earlier.
So I jumped around a bit. I started by talking about webs of trust and schemas, and then I jumped to the design of the systems, in other words, the primitives of how we're creating these things. The web of trust stuff, the stuff I'm describing more recently, is all stuff that we've either already created or are creating next. In other words, these are the shorter term goals that we will deliver, is these primitives, these abilities to, you know, interact with keys and HyperCore and, you know, monetize files and things like this. The web of trust part comes into play once you have an established network of peers that have keys. Now you'll be able to add like reputation systems, and you'll be able to add context to these keys. And so I could say, keep a core that is, you know, all of my ratings of Bitcoiners. I could say, you know, this, maybe it's the asshole rating scale. And so I will say, hey, here's a schema of like, you know, here's how I rate Bitcoiners. Here's the data required to, here's how you parse my ratings. And here's how you can submit ratings to me. And so we would attest these ratings back and forth to each other, and then we would establish a scoring system. And then if I wanted to, this is what Web of Trust is, I could say, okay, the Bitcoiners that you rate as being not an asshole, I could have some transitive trust. In other words, I'm going to say every Bitcoiner that you think is a zero on the asshole scale, or thus very much not an asshole, I'm going to say I'm going to weight their data as a one. Like more than zero. I mean, sorry, I should say minus one. I should have used a different scaling mechanism. In other words, I'm going to attribute one extra point of trust to them because you think they're not assholes. And that becomes like a perspective I can have on data. I can say, okay, all of these keys, when they have something, when I interact with them, they're going to have like one more scoring level, one more level of trust in whatever way that I'm using or applying trust because you trust them. And so you can, and
is this something you, okay, is this something you would do individually, or is this something that services would pop up to do?
Both.
Okay.
Like, for example, like right now we have things like Trustpilot where you can submit a rating.
These things are
very easy to Sybil attack. And so the users need to be rated as well. And so you need more interoperable systems so you can filter out bad data. Like if you go and look at reviews on Amazon, you don't know which ones are real, which ones are made by Amazon, which ones are made by the seller. You know, like they're on different languages. Like your ability to manage and research what has integrity is like totally from somebody else's perspective. But now you would be able to choose the perspective. Like you'd be able to put on a perspective by choosing which schema for a web of trust you wanted to apply, and thus filter out which data mattered to you and how much. And so it's kind of like a way of inverting a Google search algorithm. It's like, instead of, and that's where the idea originally came from. Actually, I had parts of this idea like 10 years ago or more, where my idea was I wanted to make a Google killer. And I was like, well, what sucks about Google is they don't publish their weightings. They don't give the user the ability to re-weight things. And then they started to kind of do it where, like, you know, originally Google was just a search engine, and then it became like filters where you had like a images page and a news page. And these are kind of reweightings of the data. It's saying, okay, prioritize data that is of this type, or, you know, weight it more highly. And so it's a way of doing that from your own preferences and from, and also through the lens of the people that you trust. So you can have some sort of like system for drilling down data that is relevant to you and to your own subjective values.
Yeah, that's really cool. So what's, for people listening, why is Bitcoin important to all of this? What makes this possible now that Bitcoin exists?
Because if Bitcoin really does like disrupt the system, and we don't have major players that we trust, we probably shouldn't be trusting them now. We still need some way to enforce like what is good and what is bad and what is valuable and what is spam and what is not. And right now we're outsourcing that. We're outsourcing that to Google. We're outsourcing that to the government. But we need some way of self-regulating. And so thus we need to basically manage our own reputations. So we need to track the reputations of others. But the only way to do this in a way that it's not dystopian is if you do it yourself. Like, if you trust somebody else to do it, you're just reverting to what we already have. You're just creating new governments and new Googles. That's all you'll end up doing. But if you make it all interoperable, and so that way, like, in other words, Twitter is just a website that you allow to serve your Twitter feed. And if Twitter bans you, you just have somebody else serve it, or you serve it yourself. Like, you never change. Your account is always your key. It's just whether or not Twitter serves your key or not. And so Twitter like no longer has power over you, right? They become a service for providing scale. They say, okay, well, yes, you have your own Twitter feed, but you don't have enough expertise or enough resources to serve your 1 million followers in any efficient way. Because if you had 1 million people contacting your laptop all day, it would explode. And so we're going to provide scaling services for you, and they will have to either monetize this through advertising like they do now, or injecting ads into the user experience, or through you paying them to do it for them. And so unless you would have to monetize your feed yourself. But the difference is that Twitter is no longer in power of the marketplace. The marketplace is ephemeral. The marketplace is mm-hmm. your marketplace. Mm-hmm. They're your followers. Mm-hmm. And they just need to know where to find your file. And so it's like, following you on Twitter is like finding somebody to download, you know, I don't know, The Hangover 2 from, you know,
okay. You on Twitter is. So what is the challenge with, because I guess for Twitter to become a scaling service in this paradigm, they would need to adopt some of the interoperable standards that you guys are working on, right? Like, so is that part of the challenge effectively here? Is that have these walled gardens that don't want to do any of this shit, right?
Oh, they will not want to do it. They anytime they have approached this, they have regretted it and removed these features. Like when Hootsuite and what was the other one? Like that Twitter app that you could like load multiple accounts into. When these things started to become successful, Twitter just buys them. Like, because, and then Twitter shuts down the APIs that, to, you know, for things that let people add the features that they want. And then Twitter adds the features themselves. Like when Clubhouse becomes popular, Twitter adds spaces. Like Twitter just becomes a monopoly and a giant, and they just enforce this walled garden. And like your ability to export data and automate the exporting of data is basically very, very impractical or not there at all. And so when something like Mastodon comes around, there's no way to like truly like move to Mastodon, because you can't take your followers with you. You have to like convince them to also use Mastodon. You can't have this interoperable thing where like everything you do on Mastodon gets fed to Twitter, and everything you do on Twitter gets fed to Mastodon, and they're just all blur and it doesn't make a difference where you tweet from. That would be nice, right? But unfortunately, if you did that, then Twitter's stock would go down, because Twitter wouldn't be able to monopolize you and be a marketplace. And that's the difference, is it makes the marketplace a peer-to-peer marketplace. And so your marketplace is your ability to get people to be interested in you and your reputation. and not your ability to, convince Twitter not to keep you around or to boost your signal.
Yeah. You're still faced with the same bootstrapping problem that Mastodon is faced with, though, right? It's still dependent upon an initial, I guess, let's call it a competition to Twitter that needs to emerge in order to force Twitter's hand to become interoperable. But when they do, they've let the barbarians in the gates, right?
Right. So Twitter would never make it easy to leave Twitter for whatever it is that we provide.
Mm-hmm.
That's not lost on me. But what I'll say is that, like, Mastodon had similar problems to Twitter, and some of its designs made it unappealing in some way that people didn't want to move to. Like, you still needed to trust a server and a host, and you could still be banned from that host. And so it was still like, it was just more marketplaces.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a halfway house. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so the difference here is that if you did this, you would be able to serve your own data if you wanted to and could, to a small set of people at least. And you would be able to participate in as many Mastodons as you wanted automatically. You wouldn't need to like choose one, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, you still have the problem of migrating from existing infrastructure. And the only way to do that is either for people to already be looking for this. In other words, I got banned from Twitter and now I'm mm-hmm. just on with Twitter. Mm-hmm. Or, Twitter, I'm tired of all the ads on Twitter, or I'm tired of all the misinformation labels on tweets, or I'm tired of getting shadow banned or shadow de-weighted. And Twitter does a lot of this. Like,
mm-hmm.
Just as an example, like if you tweet something with a YouTube link in it, like a music video on with a YouTube link in it, Twitter won't show it to other people. They won't tell you. But they'll just specifically de-weight those tweets because probably something to do with copyright, and they don't want exposure, or they just don't want people going to YouTube. They want people leaving the site. They know that YouTube's too big. Whatever reason, those tweets get de-weighted heavily. And I noticed this because as a somewhat popular Bitcoiner, if I want to just tweet like a song I'm listening to, nobody ever sees it. And, like, I get like two likes
something. Yeah. Same with Spotify.
I was like, I get like 50 likes if I like make a fart sound. Like, why can't I get like 20 likes on a song? Like, it's a good song. What the fuck? You know, like it's they de-weight these things. Anyway, one way would be for people to like just be dissatisfied and be looking for a better alternative. And this would be a really good long-term one to bet on. Another one would be if we can actually provide user experiences that Twitter can't because of the design. And we can do that. I'm not going to share. These are kind of secret sauce things, mm-hmm. but we do have some specific things that we will use to show how if you do things this way, you actually can do things that Twitter can't do. Mm-hmm. And that will, I don't know if they're going to be compelling enough, but they're certainly going to be interesting. And I don't know if they're going to be good enough to kill Twitter, but I'm going to do my best. And I will say maybe one area, which is that when you have an interoperable system, you can introduce things that Twitter can't with reputation and introduce things with gamification. And so you can have scores and badges and reputations and multiple types of reputations. And Twitter's equivalent of this is like you can get a blue badge if you KYC with them.
So, I think there's the...
You could have like... You know Hive.one where they like read mm-hmm. Bitcoiners on here? Like that could be part of the user experience. It could be like when you look at Adam Back's profile or when you see his responses, there's a little badge saying he's the number one Bitcoiner. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that could be part of an integrated experience. And Twitter can't do that. Twitter won't do that. You could have the orange, people wanted to do the orange check mark, instead of the blue check mark. Like if you've paid a Lightning payment to check mm-hmm, on mm-hmm. a robot, like you could do this, no problem, like very easily. And you could do it in any way you wanted. It could be with Lightning, it could be with PayPal, it could be with just an attestation. It could be like, this is the badge of people that, Zvetsky trusts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I could just have a Zvetsky badge and maybe everybody just, that becomes popular and everybody wants one, This is one dimension of things that we're looking into. It's just how to reflect and gamify reputation, and so people become proud of their achievements and their place in their communities.
Yeah, I feel like there's another way is also having high profile people who are currently dissatisfied. So let's say, you know, having a Trump or an Elon Musk become this kind of person, right? That's kind of like a bootstrapping effect, right? In a sense?
Yeah, but the only way to do that is to pay them. Like, yeah, they're not going to give up their whole crowd. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, in other words, imagine like going to Dan Held and being like, hey, Dan Held, you have, you know, X 100K followers. Will you come use my platform? You'd be like, no, I'll be a nobody again. Like, he would never do it. You know, somebody that's like an outlaw or an outcast, yeah, they would do it. And they have nothing to lose. But like, but if you said to Dan Held, hey, I'll give you $10 million if you just keep tweeting to everybody for a month that you're leaving and you're going to this platform, or we'll give you $5 per head that migrate with you, then maybe you'd be able to do it. But like, come on, that doesn't scale at all. Like, I'm going to pay every Dan Held to come use the new system. No. They need to feel FOMO. They need to feel like if they're not there, they're missing out. And so you have the cool thing here is, we're trying to create a marketplace that would be way bigger than Twitter. It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
it's like, it's all the Twitters, you know? It would take years to establish that, but that's what we're, you know, that's the potential there.
Yeah. So
Facebook and your Twitter, it could all be the same thing.
You know? All in one. So are you guys focused more on building the protocol primitives or the actual applications that'll use those protocol primitives or both?
We're doing the whole ecosystem. And so where we started is first we shipped BlockTank, which is a LSP server, which we totally open sourced. And this is just because basically like there's infrastructure we need to build that we need in place to do the things we want to do. And so we're just releasing these as products as they become ready. And so it's basically like a way to buy and automate channel sales and channel balancing. And so in other words, Lightning sucks, man. Like Lightning is very shitty. Like it's really cool because of what it enables for Bitcoin, but the actual like technology and what you have to manage to make it for a user is really, really shitty. And so part of what's necessary to make it less shitty is to have this server in place that you can automatically communicate with. So you can kind of piece out and separate the part of the user experience or part of the requirements that make Lightning possible. And automate them to a server. And so BlockTank is a way of having an API where, you know, either any front end like a website or an app or any other Lightning node can automatically buy channels, you know, get top ups to their channels and manage this problem of Lightning. And so you can kind of put it behind the infrastructure so the user doesn't have to deal with it. And you can create new user experiences for Lightning this way. And so that was the thing we finished first. So it's what we released first. Then slash tags we've been working on constantly and adding new primitives. You know, we have a priority list to where we get to the eventual end point with all the things that we've discussed today and more. But there's a certain order these things need to be done to be possible. And we've been working on that for about a year, maybe a little bit more now. And we have actually a work in progress SDK where people could start playing with it now. We're just not really promoting it very much because it's still kind of alpha and we sometimes make breaking changes, so it's not really you'd be taking a risk to start using it now, but the idea is that we will have it be in its first like frozen state or usable state by the time we release our mobile app wallet, and that will be in September, October roughly. That's probably my plan, is to, you know, announce this at the Honey Badger conference and, you know, preview this. And so we'll release the wallet, and that will kind of be like the toolkit for the whole ecosystem. And that will be the first kind of home-based toolkit for slash tags as well. And so you'll be able to hold your account keys in there and your contacts and things like this. And at the same time, we'll also be integrating with some websites, so you can see how you could use this, you know, with other websites like Bitfinex and things like this. And then somewhere in the middle there, probably in a month or two, we'll start making the publishing platform. And this is kind of like the answer to Google, and we'll show you how to do all this file storage and file monetization and cloud storage and cloud purchasing of hosting, you know, through this whole system. And that'll probably be, you know, a good 6 months, probably more, before we show that to people. So next year, you know, we'll reveal the publishing platform and how to use slash tags and Hypercore to do that. And then at the same time, maybe staggered another 3 months after that, we'll start working on, or, you know, to release concurrently, work at the same time, a social media platform. And this will be the kind of the way of expressing all of the ways of communicating, of having social media feeds, and of establishing and starting the early primitives for reputation and webs of trust. And so each of these different platforms expresses the different ways to use keys and slash tags in this kind of, you know, imagined economy. We call it the atomic economy, which is just a way of including Bitcoin as a primitive for value, Lightning as a primitive for payments, slash tags as a primitive for identity, accounts, and, you know, abstracting metadata, and then webs of trust and HyperCore for doing storage and reputation, things like this. And so we combine all of these things into multiple products. And we have a few other things in the middle there that we're working on that are kind of secret at the moment that we'll announce in between. And that kind of fills all the gaps. And so after we have the first version of all these things done, probably, you know, another year, year and a half till we have the first version of the whole ecosystem done. We have another set of things we want to work on after that, which will be like, we want to tackle privacy and see what the best way is to implement, you know, privacy for Bitcoin, Lightning, and this ecosystem, and probably things like chat and video and some of the harder things. But yeah, we're just going to keep working until basically, like, hyper Bitcoinization digital society will be ready for you before society yeah. is ready for it. That's the plan.
Dude, I love it. This is I love the approach as well, being such a because there's people, you know, trying to do, you know, I'm not going to name any names, but, like, you know, decentralized fucking Twitters and all this sort of stuff, but they don't have a fucking plan. They don't have a process, and you know, their timeline.
What are you, a nice guy or something?
Apparently. I want to keep close to the zero on the asshole scale, okay? When it's ready.
Yeah, you're worried about this. I understand.
I'm planning ahead. But no, honestly, man, I think the way you're approaching it, the long-term approach and everything, I think is I don't know, it's very exciting. I was out of the whole computer space for many years, and it was actually Bitcoin that kind of brought me more back into this kind of software. So, like, when we caught up in Houston, that was the first time I even heard of the word web of trust. And but, you know, as you explained it, it kind of clicked to me, and I was like, fuck, that's very interesting. And then everything else that you're doing, man, I'm glad that there's people like you who are working on this stuff, because, I mean, I'm for damn sure going to be someone who uses this and wants to interact with this, because, you know, my time in the Twitterverse, et cetera, is not going to be long. Like, you know, I already get videos banned off YouTube and shit banned off Twitter and all that sort of stuff. So, and it's not just the banning component. It's also just the idea of, self-ownership across other dimensions, more than just my money, right? Or more than just my game in the scorecard. Let me take that back.
It's self-sovereignty, you know, across the board. It's just giving everybody, if you wanted to host everything yourself, always control who got your data first. Always control who knew who you are or what version of you show to people. This is the system for doing that. Like, that's the whole goal is, like, if we're going to have a system that, like, actually, you know, can escape the current paradigm, that this is what I thought needed to be in place. So I appreciate your consideration on this and your support when it's ready. I'll disclaim that, like, I know that some of the people listening will be like, what the fuck is he talking about? Or that sounds impossible, or that sounds way too hard, or it's going to take him 5 years, not two. And you'll be right about some of those claims, probably, and wrong. But my goal is to prove you wrong, if that's how you feel. I think my motives are pure and good, and I'm doing my best to make our whole brand and motivation to be benevolent and to be something to, like, enable users and empower them. But it's hard to explain in even an hour. It's hard to explain on a podcast, you know,
totally.
shooting from the hip. And so I know that some of these things are intimidating or confusing or sound weird. I just hope that, you know, the people that have been interested in my perspectives on things and maybe think I am pretty rational and have some experience with this, do just give it a chance, because that's why we're doing the apps also, not just protocols, is because we know we have to put it in your hands to fully understand.
Mm-hmm,
it.
And we
will do that. Like it will all make sense once the whole ecosystem is done. It will all fit together, and it will make more and more sense with each thing that we release. And for now, I know that it's like still a little bit like, what the hell is John doing, and what the, you know, why did they release an LSP and these kinds,
man,
of
good things take time. That's it. You know, this is, yeah. You know, there's also a lag between what you're building, what you're releasing, what people are using, how you evolve it, and, you know, getting saturation in something like this as well. That, like, anything that is paradigmatic, that is a paradigm shift, I guess, is you know, it's a long process, but I mean, just like,
and we will need your support. We will need listener support, because we're up against some pretty big players now. Jack and Block and TBD with these Web 5 narratives, and it's like there are people. Like, I think the design that we have, the model that we have, is actually really good and probably the best solution. And if I'm right about that, I think I'm also right about that. I think that there is only one best solution in the end, and that everybody will converge on it, which means we're going to have more and more competition with more and more competing narratives. And it's already begun. And so I have some confidence that we're doing the right thing, because more people are trying to do things that we're doing, including really large people like Jack and Jack Dorsey and his subsidiary companies that he's formed in the Bitcoin world. But their designs are not as good. And I hope that people don't just, you know, get distracted by things because of affinity and because of fame, that the people are putting too much trust in what they're doing without it being warranted at this time. They're shipping a lot of pitch decks or decks, presentation decks and specs, but they're not shipping any code. We are shipping code. And I just hope that people do give us a fair chance with what we do.
I hope so too, man. I mean, I actually hope that there's as much interoperability between what you're doing and what TBD and Jack and stuff are doing. I hope that there's a marriage between the two in some way.
In the end, there's only so much you can do. In other words, interoperability is still, in the end, two people using the same thing. And that thing, as long as that thing is highly abstracted, it can have a lot of versions of the thing, and then you're okay. But there are always going to be edges to this. And another problem is when you implement these things, even as if they're abstracted, you end up implementing them in like one language first. So in other words, like everything we do is JavaScript. And so, you know, the more, this is a pretty good basis, because there's a lot of, you know, JavaScript developers, and thus there will be a lot of people, you know, that would be interested in playing with it. But like, for example, if the big thing that takes off, like with Lightning Labs, they work in Go and LND. This is not a very huge thing. It's niche. And so that means that, like, if we have aspirations for doing something with LND, our hands are tied unless we start hiring a Go team. And why would I, like, I'm not going to hire a Go team just because of one service, because of one thing. And so it just ends up not happening. And you don't get the interoperability or the convergence of talent and things like this. You end up getting monopoly. You end up getting where Lightning Labs hires all the Go devs, and now they control that ecosystem. And if it keeps becoming popular, it becomes entrenched. And so there's good parts and there's trade-offs. The same thing could happen with TBD, you know, the Web5 Jax thing. And if they make all their stuff, say, in Rust, or they make all the stuff to a very specific, elaborate spec, and we make something more abstract in JavaScript. Now, technically, both could probably work together, but whose developers are going to take the time to make something that uses both and talks to both? Or, you know, are the Rust guys going to do JavaScript? Are the JavaScript guys going to do Rust? Like, where does the line get drawn? Sometimes there's a practicality thing that ends up forking interoperability.
this is where you need someone like me to create the bridge between both you motherfuckers, so we can make sure that there's something there.
Well, sometimes what I'm trying to say is it's not just about politics. It's about actual resources.
Totally. Understood. John, I think we've gone way more than what we originally anticipated. I got the
little, my headphones are dying noise.
Yeah. What's is there anything final you want to kind of mention? I know where people can find you, where they can support Synonym, I guess that's probably a big one.
Sure. Our website is synonym.to, synonym.to. The Twitter is synonym_to. We also have a Twitter for Block Tank, which is the LSP. You can check out and play with, we made a demo app of the LSP, like if you want to buy Lightning Channel, so you can play with that at our website in the products page, or synonym.to/blocktank. Keep an eye out for a bunch of announcements this fall at the conferences. We're going to be at conferences like 3 or 4 in a row, September in Riga, then is Lugano. We're doing a conference where the whole kind of like Synonym and Bitfinex and Tether and Hypercore, you know, that company is called Hole Punch, where we'll be having several announcements, both together and of new products and stuff. And then again, another conference, I'll be adopting Bitcoin again in El Salvador. So I'll be out there this fall. And then we've been doing Synonym Spaces, which is every month we've been doing spaces. And I don't know when you're going to release this, but the next one will be in a couple of weeks. And we're going to do it about, you know, Web3 and the differences between how different people define it, and, you know, differences between what we're doing and what Web5 is, and, you know, getting into the details here for people that are interested to learn more. But every month we do that. And then I also have the Biz podcast, which is kind of neglected lately. But my plan is actually the next one is supposed to be with Steve Lee from Block, from Square.
Okay.
So we'll see if we can meet in the middle somehow on stuff there. We are actually working with LDK now, which is their Lightning their Lightning development kit. And so we're implementing that for use in our mobile wallet. There is some overcoming of politics. We're also participating in a few standards groups now. Like we made a web standard that combines WebLN with WebBTC, and we're working with the LSP standards group with some of the guys from Block and other LSPs. And so we've got a lot going on. I'm rambling at this point, but if you want to support me, find me on Twitter, Bitcoin Error Log. And you can find all the rest from there.
Beautiful. All right, my man. Thank you so much for joining. This was, for me, a very educational conversation, I think, in everything we touched, whether it was the unpopular opinions, the game, and then everything that you're doing with Synonym. I love having conversations like this. So really appreciate it.
Well, really
I'd love to do it again as well in a year, because then we can kind of like follow up on some of these things and see also the progress of what's happening. With Synonym.
Yeah, hold me accountable. Next year, 100%. It'll be like, all we released was the wallet and nothing else. And like, John, what's going on?
For sure, man.
Thank you for listening to the Wake Up Podcast. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. I'll try and read the new tweet and send you a shout out. And remember to grab a copy of the Uncommunist Manifesto and join us in defeating plague that is consuming our world.